Hello, and welcome to episode 42 of the Venture Games podcast. I'm Chris Quaidu, a venture partner at Griffin Gaming Partners, one of the leading gaming-focused VC firms, and content acquisition lead at Andreessen-backed CarryFirst, the leading African mobile games publisher. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by another games industry legend, Trip Hawkins. Trip has accomplished a ton in his nearly 5-decade career, but he's perhaps best known for founding Electronic Arts. Trip, how's it going?
It's going great. Hello, everyone.
Awesome. Thank you for joining me. To kick things off, I usually ask for folks to give their background, but I wanted to break it up here given you've done so much. So first, I just wanted to start out with, I think some folks are more intrinsically motivated as entrepreneurs, whereas other folks are sort of, pushed into it or influenced by external factors. I'm always curious to hear, for career and lifelong entrepreneurs like yourself, which of these two do you think fits you better?
Well, I think, there's a lot of things that, abilities we have and aptitudes that we are born with. We're just every one of us is better at some things and worse at some things. And of course, when you're a little kid, you don't really know that much about civilization. You haven't been to school a lot yet. You haven't read a lot of books yet. You've just been in with your family, and maybe you have noticed some of your personal characteristics, because anything you notice about yourself at an early age, it's either the product of your ancestry, or it's a consequence of the childhood trauma that you've been suffering from since you were born that has caused you to make some adaptations. I think as an entrepreneur, a lot of it is just wired into me. The same goes for things like leadership and strategic thinking. There's been a lot of research, particularly using twin studies. These days, having broken the genome, we're going to start accelerating our understanding of what gets passed on versus what doesn't. But I've read a lot about twin studies where if you have identical twins and they're separated at birth, like they're both given up for adoption, they end up growing up on two different continents and two different families. And then they both turn out to be nuclear physicists, or they both turn out to be astronauts. I mean, these crazy things that suggests that, oh, maybe the context of how you grow up and where you go to school and, what your family teaches you and cares about, it's just this question of nature versus nurture. And every human is an amazing creation. Oh my God. I mean, humans have it so good. Of course, we're also our own worst enemies, which is a bit of a problem. But yeah, we've got all these incredible abilities. And, as you get older, you get to know yourself better, you interact with more people, you notice people's strengths and weaknesses, including your own. So it's easier for me now, in hindsight, to answer your question, because I think really at a young age, when television was still black and white, and I also had a transistor radio when those came out, so not the most impressive electronics, but I was able to discover these things called football and baseball. And I thought they were absolutely mind-bogglingly amazing. Now, those have nothing to do with my genetics, everything to do with my culture that I'm around. I believe that a couple of the gifts I got from my ancestors are, I'm a pretty much natural leader. I am a, willing to take risks. I think some of that is my, neurotic side. And then, I'm very much a strategic thinker. I know I have really good pattern recognition, spatial cognition, things that have to do with assessing an environment and figuring out how to navigate through it and how to develop a plan and, how to research a situation and figure out a strategy. Those are just things that I have learned because I've worked with a lot of executives. There are literally hundreds of executives that I worked with in my career that went on to be CEOs. And in the last decade, I've been specifically spent a lot of my time being an advisor to CEOs of next-gen startups. And one of the things that just came as an absolute shock to me is that there are things that I automatically do that many other CEOs don't do.
What are some good examples?
Planning. Planning is the best example because, first of all, the most important thing in leadership is you had better have a good plan. And you had better be good at persuading your team to believe in that plan of their own volition. They've got to have agency and go, okay, I'm listening to this pitch. And if it doesn't make any sense to me, maybe I don't want to be here. I mean, you're better off with those people leaving.
Sure.
No, but basically, you've got to have a plan that makes sense, that they can understand, and they can adopt it of their own free will. And when they reach their own conclusion that the plan makes sense, this is something Dale Carnegie said a long time ago, people don't doubt their own conclusions. But you'd better have a good plan, and you better be good at breaking it down and explaining it. It's a just kind of an automatic thing. Nobody taught me in school, oh, you have to do this, and you have to do it in a certain way. Basically, already had it built into me to know that that was necessary. So when I was in school and I went to business school and took various classes, it certainly supplemented my understanding of how to do good planning. But I would have done good planning without having gone to business school.
Awesome. So it definitely sounds like a lot of it was sort of intrinsically motivated. And I think this is probably one of the reasons why you got into entrepreneurship at such an early age. So what actually was your first business?
Yeah, so with my love of baseball and football, and you can relate to this because every kid that watches TV, we all go outside afterwards and pretend to be our heroes. And of course, if you're a sports fan, you're going to throw a ball around, you're going to kick a ball around, you're going to reenact your greatest sports hero's biggest moments. And so I was very much like that, but being a strategic thinker, that was not enough for me. So I'm looking at these games and I'm noticing how strategy comes into it. Like you look at a pitcher trying to strike out a hitter, or and a hitter trying to hit a home run. You look at a football team, which is kind of like a military force trying to capture territory. And football is a total metaphor for warfare. And you may not know this, but the word strategy comes from a Latin word, stratagem. The meaning of stratagem is the maneuverings of a general. So everything about strategy really does come from military, and football is kind of an expression of that. And the scoring system in football is that if you capture all the territory, you get points. You can get 6 points if you move the ball into the end zone to prove that you control all 100 yards of the field. And if you can't move it in by hand with a person carrying it, you can still kick it between the uprights and get 3 points for that, And then you have to start over and let the other guys have a chance to attack your defense. So it's just kind of obvious. Nobody had to tell me that these games had strategy. That's what was turning me on. And I thought, I want to be able to use those strategies. I can't really do that in the yard with one friend. Okay, how can I do that? And of course, I'd already started playing board games and card games. And I realized, wow, there are actually some fairly primitive first generation products that are trying to offer some level of simulation of sports. And there was a product called All-Star Baseball that had these spinners, and you'd have a piece of paper and it would say Babe Ruth on it, and it would have a big pie slice for a home run and a big pie slice for a strikeout. And if it was his turn to bat, you put his little donut piece of paper over the spinner, and then you spin it to find out if he's going to strike out this time or hit a game, winning home run. That's where I noticed I was fascinated by statistics. But basically, at a very young age, I kind of noticed, wow, there are probabilities here. This is statistics. And different outcomes that are good or bad have different likelihoods of happening under different circumstances, depending on how you're attacking your opponent and how they're defending or attacking you back. So, again, it's back to the strategy. And I realized, okay, so here I am getting to pretend I'm Babe Ruth, or getting pretend that I'm the manager of the team he's on. This is very cool. So I had this voracious appetite as a little kid to find every possible existing game that had anything to do with sports. And of course, they were almost all really terrible. They didn't really do anything. Like I'm talking about the stupid things where you have the vibrating field with the football players. And they all just end up piled up in a corner. It doesn't in any way resemble actual football. So a lot of people have fond memories of that silly game. But in the 1960s, and I'm a kid, this game came out called Strat-O-Matic Baseball. And to me, it was like the Dungeons and Dragons equivalent for a sports game. And it was a great baseball game. And basically, you had a bunch of cards. You had players that had all these different ratings. You had charts. You had dice. You had play calling. You set your lineups. All the stuff that you get to do if you're really managing a baseball team. And of course, you could also even customize a team. This is before fantasy sports. In fact, my buddies and I actually invented some of the things that have become standards of fantasy sports. It's just I never commercialized any of my fantasy sports innovations. But for example, we were doing snake drafts before that was a thing.
Really? Wow.
We were choosing our players before the season started, before that was a thing. Anyway, my buddies and I, even as a kid, we brought a certain level of sophistication to it. And I remember the day when I'm studying some of these cards and I deduced Bayesian probability theory. I didn't know that's what it was called, but I'm looking at the cards, I'm looking at the dice, and I'm realizing, oh my God, there are six ways to roll a seven. And there's only one way to roll box cars. This guy's more valuable because he's got a home run on seven. This other guy's only got a home run on two. I mean, it was like, whoa, oh my God, this just opened up a whole new world, right? And of course, D&D is very, very cool because it can become in your mind hyper realistic and high stakes. You might get killed by this dragon that's protecting a treasure you want. D&D, every one of us in the game industry, we owe a tremendous debt to Gary Gygax and D&D. And I hadn't even stumbled across that yet. I was so focused on sports at the time. So anyway, I love their baseball game, but by then I was really more of a football fan and I was playing football. And I ended up playing football into my first couple of years of college. And so I'm really into football. And then I find out that in 1967, they were going to bring out a football game. And so, of course, I was all excited about that. I got it. And it was just terrible. By this time, I'm basically preparing to be a high school football player. And I'm reading all kinds of sophisticated books about football. And, I know a tremendous amount about football and how it works and how plays get called and what players have to do, both on offense and defense. In high school, I was a two-way player that hardly ever came off the field. So, in fact, I was, beginning to entertain the idea that my career might be as a football coach. My best friend who was playing these games with me, he did become a football coach. So we're really into this stuff. The Stratomatic football offering is just so terrible. It had nothing to do with football. It was just all these arbitrary things like, oh, the defense is going to predict that it's a run. Defenses don't do that. So there's these details of how the game really works that were just being corrupted by Stratomatic. And also they didn't really involve most of the players. So basically the quarterback had a card, your lead running back had a card, and those were the two cards that a lot of dice rolls ended up on. So they were getting way too much credit for what's going on. And then the defense, they just kind of abstracted it like, oh, okay, we're just going to give you a couple of cards for the entirety of what the defense does. Well, that's not how the defense works. There's 11 guys over there and they all play an important role and it's different. And I want to be able to decide, I'm going to double team this guy. I'm going to go zone on the other side of the field. I'm going to blitz this guy. I'm going to have this linebacker spying on the quarterback because I know that quarterback likes to run. I want to call him a real football defensive player. Anyway, by that time I realized, I could make a better game than this. And I just sort of noticed that thought bubble coming out of my brain. And I thought, okay, why don't you? Whoa.
Let's talk about it. So, what did you do next?
Yeah, so I just started trying to invent a game that would be really like football and involve all the players and properly measure their degree of contribution. By that time, was watching a lot of football games and reading magazines and reading box scores and all the newspaper stuff. So I had, a pretty good idea about a lot of details, including statistics that weren't even reported, like tackles. I had a good sense of the teams that I watched on television, who the good tacklers were, who the good pass rushers were, who the great one-on-one cover guys were, who's more likely to get a pick, stuff like that. And even with offensive linemen, there's differences in how well they pass block versus run block. I know enough about the players. I know how to rate the players. And I got to design game mechanics and the flow of it. And I was inspired by lots of games, other people's commercial games that I played before. So I drew heavily from the experience I've had with certainly well over 100 other board game products. But I invented a new kind of tabletop card dice chart-based football game. And once I had a working prototype and I'm playing with my friends and I'm refining it, it feels like, yeah, this is a commercially viable product. By that time, I'm in high school, and I went to my father and I said, "Hey, I'd like to commercialize this. Can you loan me some money?" And he loaned me $5,000, which was a lot of money in those days. And of course, I had to pay it back, so there's that. Anyway, I just started figuring out, okay, what are the parts that I need in the game and how do I get them made? And my father introduced me to a few marketing services companies, like one that could do, art layouts that, you could take it to a printer and they could run the whatever number of copies you needed. And I found this big printing company. It's funny, they're probably still there in downtown San Diego. This is kind of a big deal to drive into downtown San Diego and find this printer and go in there. And their name was Nyanesh. And my buddy that was helping with all this stuff, he never really could pronounce it or say it. He just called them Nyanyanya. But anyway, the Nyanesh printers, I brought them the card stock on which to print player cards and other charts. And they did all that printing work. And I was able to even, get them to die cut certain things. And then I bought a shit ton of dice. I mean, man, did I own a lot of dice. And I had a whole box that had hundreds of dice left over. And I ended up keeping that thing for decades. It's like, hey, I'm never going to run out of dice. I'm always going to need dice. I might as well keep this. Over the years, if I ever needed any dice, I knew where to go. The most complicated part was the game boards, which ended up being lithographed. So I designed the layout of the game boards, and then I went to, that marketing service firm so they could professionally put it on a blueprint that could go to a lithographer. So it was a reasonably high quality product. And I found a box and put a sticker on the cover, with the product and company name. It was called Accu-Stat Pro Football. I had no idea how to sell them. There was no retail channel that was going to sell these things, and I only had a little bit of money, so I bought some ads in programs to the NFL teams in Southern California where I lived, and I put a couple ads in hobby football magazines, and I sold a few hundred games. It was not a giant thing, but the people that bought the games and played the games, they sent me all kinds of love letters about how fabulous it was, and that was the first authentic ever in football game, which was true.
Did you end up actually making money off of this first business?
No, I lost every penny.
Okay.
But here's what I got out of it. I got two really important things out of it. Number one, I thought, wow, I'm having so much fun being an entrepreneur. This is really cool. I want to do this again. But next time, I want to get it right. So I didn't start another company until Electronic Arts, and that was a decade later. And the other thing was, it was bitterly disappointing. This is my creation. This is my artistic contribution. And it had been soundly defeated in the commercial world. And it just really hurt. I thought that was just nothing that kind of stuck to my ribs, like, okay, I'm not going to do this again until I really know what I'm doing.
So, last question on this before we get into EA, but how do you as an entrepreneur balance that, right? Like, you think your idea is great, you are pouring your blood, sweat, and tears into this thing, and then the market just tells you this isn't the one.
Sometimes you have to put a product out there. Of course, these days with free to play, the ability to go do a test market thing in Australia, that kind of thing, you have the ability to do a lot of live research with live customers in the thousands. So you get statistically valid sample sizes. And I've worked on games that have gone for several years in test, getting constantly refined and more money invested in them. Because once you go global, and you start wanting to spend marketing money to get users, it's really a one-shot deal. You only get to be new once. And you better have refined it to that point of whatever perfection means for that particular product. And your results need to be good enough because, especially today, the user acquisition costs are very expensive. And you're going to need to collect money from that user over a period of years. And it's going to have to all stack up right financially. Otherwise, no one's going to want to invest. And that's really the litmus test. Frankly, when I had too much of my own money sitting in a bank, I got really sloppy and had a tendency to deploy it. And it's actually a lot healthier if, as you're developing your ideas as an entrepreneur, if you can't convince anybody else to invest in it, maybe it's not that great of an idea. It just doesn't work to think, oh, they're all wrong and I'm right.
Yeah.
You just can't think that way. Maybe you have a good idea. Maybe you're just not explaining it well. Maybe you're not paying attention to what the gateway requirements are to get to funding. A lot of entrepreneurs don't really understand how critical it is to get third-party funding.
So yeah, let's talk about EA.
Well, so I made that board game. And one of the things I noticed about my friends, all of them, a broader assortment of friends, because, you know, if you really like to play games, like I always have, then you're going to find every kid in the neighborhood, every kid at school that might play a game with you. You're going to invite them over.
Sure.
And one of the things I noticed is that many of them didn't have the patience for these games that were as complicated as D&D or Accustat. And after a while, they would just get frustrated because there was so much administration going on to operate the game. And by that time, I'd heard about computers. And what I noticed my friends sometimes doing, these were not my best friends. These were just other friends I was trying to recruit into the club, if you will. They would get up and they would wander into the family room to see what's on TV. And I had this inspiration that, oh, okay. So all this administrative crap that I can put up with, because I'm a bit of a stats freak, don't mind being really nerdy about this kind of stuff. I realized, oh, okay. So the next generation of this is going to have to be in a computer where a computer does all the administrative stuff. And then it's going to need to present pretty pictures like it is on television.
Yeah.
Okay. So I realized that in 1970, the majority of people, if the experience they're trying to have is, I want to be a hero in a dungeon and I want to slay a dragon. Well, yeah, they want to swing a big axe and they want to look like, you know, Conan, and, you know, they want to win. You look at a game like Madden today, you know, you feel like you're watching TV, but you have some kind of magic wand that's controlling where the guys are going. You know?
Cool. So on Madden, why don't you talk a little bit more about the story of Madden? How did you get Madden to sign on? And yeah, you know, I'd just love to hear more about the story.
You know, it's so funny. When I started the company, I was not trying to start a company focused on sports games. I didn't really even necessarily believe that that could be a whole company. So actually the way I was thinking is that, wow, my God, the computer, it's a new medium. This is an incredible thing from a consumer standpoint. I was one of the first to really appreciate that. And I thought, yeah, as a new medium, there's going to be a tremendous variety of artistic creation around it, a tremendous variety of media content of different kinds. And I want to have a company that is really good at engaging with the creative talent. And then, like a Hollywood company, knows how to package and promote and market it and distribute it and, you know, be the best at bringing the best to the consumer, to the public. So those are the bigger ideas in the founding of EA, the idea of, wow, this is an art form. The developers are really software artists. I want to make this like a Hollywood company that knows more about computer technology. And instead of a typical recording studio, we'll have a very different kind of studio that's full of computer tools that are running on a pretty powerful desktop computer. A third critical pillar of the strategy that I developed, and, you know, this was all kind of figured out while I was at Apple, you know, before I even started EA, but it was direct distribution. And I had been through this experience while I was at Apple, where we had six distributors scattered around the United States, and they could not raise enough capital fast enough. They couldn't get bank loans fast enough to support our growth. I realized we got to get rid of these guys or consolidate some of them by acquiring them, because we need to sell directly to the retailers so that we can control the growth of our business and not have this bottleneck. So in one day, we went from having six customers at Apple to having like 3,500, which were mostly mom and pop retail stores throughout North America. And this was back in 1980 when we did that. And the lesson that I took away from that is, dang, you know, if it makes any sense to be direct with retailers, do it from day one. You know, don't. It was a very painful transition with the company. We got sued by distributors. It was ugly and really difficult. I already banked that insight. And then as I'm looking at my strategy for EA and I'm realizing I want to be like a Hollywood company, I'm noticing, wow, these Hollywood companies, they all are distribution titans. They all go directly to retail. And by having a direct relationship with the retailers, they get closer to the public. They get closer to the consumers that come into those stores. They have access to those customers and they have the ability to influence merchandising, display, promotion, market share. You have a lot of things that you can influence about the store, which is not the case if you're going through two-step distribution. And in the game industry at that time, there were really, really powerful distributors, and they kept too much of the money for themselves. So I was more than happy to try to disrupt that. Everybody thought it was crazy.
Yeah.
There were no independent software companies selling direct to retail.
Mm-hmm.
So here I come in to do it. And it's like pulling teeth because you got to go out and get every one of those 3,500 retailers to agree to do business with you. And they have to buy your inventory and take the risk on some new company's products. And there were some mom and pop retailers that I called on like four times over a 2-year period to get their business. And it would be like the first time, it's like, they don't even want to meet. Second time, they're listening, but they're saying, do you work with SoftCell, the leading distributor? Go, no, we don't. Okay, well, then I'm not going to work with you. Okay, well, we sell direct, and here's why we think that's a benefit. And they're just saying, thanks, but no thanks. Then you come back the third time, and they say, you know, I'm starting to hear about you guys. Like, a guy came in the other day and was asking for the Dr. J. Larry Bird Go one-on-one game. And I didn't have it. I called SoftCell and they didn't have it. Why doesn't SoftCell have it? These are guys I've met with for like three times. Mm-hmm. They know I don't sell to SoftCell. They keep forgetting that because they buy everything from SoftCell. And then they think to themselves, all right, I'm going to go ahead and take this guy's money and tell him I'm going to order it for him.
Mm-hmm.
And then he finds out SoftCell doesn't have it. We're in this meeting and he says, okay, I'll take one of those. That's all he's going to do. He's going to just take one of them because he's already got somebody that's paid for it. Okay. And then he says, yeah, and I saw that article about you guys in Time Magazine. I read about Music Instruction Set. I'll take one of those too. That was the third meeting. And then finally, by the fourth meeting, he's sold out of the things that he bought.
Mm-hmm.
He's beginning to realize that we make really good stuff. People are asking for it. And now he's ready to really place a legit, meaningful order. But man, it was a battle that went on for 3 years where you're constantly wondering, is this going to work?
Yeah.
It was the toughest hurdle to get over. But once you're over that hurdle, you basically are the distribution apparatus for games. And now it's a whole lot easier to convince artists to work with you and even other small studios to allow you to be their distribution arm. So as they say, the rest is history. So in the original business plan, I hardly talked about sports.
Mm-hmm.
In my mind, I'm thinking, oh yeah, of course I'm going to make sports games. That's what I do. But in this company, yeah, it's going to be kind of my hobby. And I don't want to make too big a deal about it in the business plan. Mm-hmm. It's all this other stuff to talk about. So it literally gets only two sentences in the whole plan. Of course, I started thinking, okay, I got to make a simple enough game that'll run on an Apple II. And other machines like that. So, you know, I ended up deciding to design the one-on-one basketball game that was inspired by a series of TV commercials I'd seen probably in the early 60s, where, in fact, you know, Home Run Derby, that actually started out as a TV commercial. And that had gone on the air in the early 50s. I never saw those. Mm-hmm. I just heard that story later. But Brill Cream or Vitalis, I forget which one of the hair cream companies. They decided, hey, let's do something like the Home Run Derby, except we'll do it with one-on-one basketball. It was very cool. They had a tournament, and every 60-second commercial was like a short, edited, tight matchup of two badass, you know, all-star basketball players, mm-hmm. right? Anyway, and then here I am decades later thinking, okay, I need a simple enough sports game. Hey, what about one-on-one basketball?
Yeah.
And I thought, yeah, you know, and I could go get my heroes. You know, Dr. J was a huge hero to me.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, hey, I'm going to go get, you know, how about Dr. Who would be the perfect villainous opponent for Dr. J? Okay, it's got to be Larry Bird, mm-hmm. you know? And there were these great photographs of him getting in a fight. I don't know if you've ever seen those pictures of them fighting.
I haven't. Because
neither one of them, those guys hardly ever got in any, you know, they're sure as heck not like Draymond Green, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
they do not pick a lot of fights.
Yeah.
And here they are at each other's throats like they're ready to kill each other. And I don't remember why the hell that happened, but there's obviously in the Northeast, a big rivalry between, you know, the big cities in the Northeast and, you know, the Celtics, you know, they had won way more than their fair share and everybody else hates them. You know, Philadelphia's hadn't won in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just a perfect setup. And fortunately, I had a lawyer who knew a lawyer that knew the agent for Julius Erving. And so we had a pathway to get into contact. And Julius is such a smart guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he had become kind of like the ambassador for basketball and won a recent championship. And he's, you know, getting ready to retire. And he had a bunch of kids. And I basically pitched him on how this is going to be a whole new thing. It's going to be a big deal. Not this game specifically, but this whole thing of computers in the home. Explained to him that there was a lot of educational value because you learn by doing, and every game, is a feedback loop. Everything that's happening, you're getting feedback and you're thinking and you're learning and it's growing new brain cells. And there was a brilliant scientist that was the first one to prove that there's neurogenesis when we're interacting. So literally, I'm explaining to Dr. J, there's a lot of educational value in this. And he and I both knew there's a lot to basketball. There's a lot of strategy. There's a lot of discipline. There's a lot of things that we can learn and become more mature, wise humans just from what can come out of basketball. And he knows that. I know that. And he's got me kind of connecting with him around that because he certainly believes in that and knows that this is a cool thing for his kids to be aware that he's involved in doing. And he was going to be a pioneering person in it, right? So he said yes. And then we went and offered Larry Bird to be the counterpart. And I got to tell you that one funny thing about that game is that there was a design session and I asked Julius, say a 15-foot jump shot, what affects your probability of making that shot? How does your shooting percentage vary depending on what part of the court you're on, how you're being defended, et cetera? He looks at me and he says, well, it depends on whether or not I have the right to miss. And I'm thinking, what? He says, yeah, if I've made my last four shots in a row, my teammates know I'm hot, that I'm in a groove, and I now can make any shot I want from anywhere on the court. And the defense knows it, and they know they have to cover every possibility. And you know what? My shooting percentage is going up. And it turns out he's actually one of the people that his data, you have all these stats junkies, they're really into trying to determine are hot streaks a real thing? Are bad streaks, are you in a slump? Is that just randomness or do you really have a mechanical problem? There's all these debates. And finally, the stat freaks studied it and they came to the conclusion that any kind of a batting streak or a strikeout streak or whatever, it's highly random. And it's not probably related to something about your actual performance. In the study that I read about, they had studied basketball and they cited Julius Erving and his shooting characteristics as an exception to the norm.
That's
Isn't
very, very interesting.
that crazy? Anyway, so he's talking about that. And of course, it was my goal in the game to, for example, make Larry Bird shoot more of the shots that he's good at making and be better at making those shots compared to the shots that are more part of Dr. J's repertoire. And a remarkable thing happened, which is that everybody that played the game, if you're a Dr. J fan, you totally feel like, wow, this is really Dr. J. This is exactly what he would do. This is how he plays. He just did this for me, and just like he does in real life. And same thing if you're the Bird fan. And the programmer never actually put the differences in. It turns out they have exactly the same chances of making every kind of shot from anywhere on the court.
The mind can definitely play tricks on you for sure.
But anyway, so there's your starting point for EA Sports. It was the first video game that ever had a celebrity co-designer or a celebrity that appeared in a game as themselves. So the success of that Dr. J game, I gave myself permission that, okay, now I can work on a team football game because that's what I really wanted to make. And that's what ultimately led to Madden. And, Dr. J and Larry Bird, we had these two covered athletes defining the game. And with football, I thought, I'd really rather work with a coach. I don't think one football player is going to, really drive a football brand. It's a more complicated sport with a whole lot more people on the field. And I thought, okay, you know what I'll do is I'll just go find a coach that I respect and I'll hire them and they'll be kind of a design partner and they'll fill in the gaps in my knowledge about football so I can design a realistic football game. And then I thought about who can I get? And I'm in the Bay Area and over in Berkeley at the campus there, Joe Capp, the former Minnesota Viking quarterback, has long since retired as a quarterback, but he's gotten into coaching and he just got hired by Cal to be the football coach. I thought, oh, he's perfect because he's not going to demand a huge amount of cash. He's not going to insist on getting a royalty. And I'll just tell him, yeah, I'm not looking to have your name on the game. I'm just looking to be, to hire you to teach me some football. And so we had a nice meeting. And then he calls me up after the meeting a couple of days later and says, yeah, I've given it some thought. And I've decided that if you want to do this with me, I want my name on the game and I want a royalty. And I thought, oh, all right, I understand that. I said, okay. Well, apparently, no matter who I work with, I'm going to need to give them a
Yeah.
share of the revenue, which means I might as well just go to the top of the pile. If I can have anybody, who would I want? And it was obvious, John Madden. And John had already won a Super Bowl. He had already become a multiple Emmy award-winning broadcaster. He was already the Ace Hardware man. He was already the Miller Lite guy breaking through the barrier at the end of the ads. He'd already actually written a few books. In fact, he'd actually even written and done some college courses where he taught women how to watch football. Now, so he's just the every he'd already become the everyman of football. And plus, he's an incredibly successful, great coach. I could see he was the right guy, and he was interested in doing it, and off we went.
And how did you meet him? And was it a tough sell to get him, or did he sort of see the vision?
He's the kind of guy that relies on his agent for these kinds of things.
Got it.
And if there's going to be enough money involved, and he looks at what it's going to require him to do. This is not just John. This is, I would say, many celebrities are going to do this. They're going to rely on their agent. There's certain parameters that the agent know have to be achieved. And if the agent comes in and says, "Okay, here's an opportunity that looks like it makes sense because it, involves the right financials and isn't too demanding of your time." And so I had to fly to New York and meet with his agent. And then once the agent decided, yeah, this makes sense, this works, basically John had then to decide to agree with what the agent was recommending, and he did that. So I hadn't met him yet. A few days later, he was crisscrossing the country on the train in those days. You know, he didn't have a Madden Cruiser yet. And so I flew out to Denver and got on the train, and we spent the next 3 days, crossing the Western United States and talking about football from sunup to late at night, which was a heck of a lot of fun.
Cool. So obviously, EA went on to be this massive, massive company. Before we move on to the next phase of your career, are there any other EA stories that you want to share?
Well, the turning point for EA, I should point out, is that Nintendo showed up with this draconian business model that everyone has since copied. And until Nintendo's arrival, every platform was open. No platform charged royalties against the content creators or had any other kinds of restrictions or review systems and approval processes and blah, blah, blah. And of course, it was even worse than that because Nintendo wanted to control a bunch of other things like the manufacturing of the games and approval of the games that, you could spend years working on something and they could reject it and it doesn't get to see the light of day. And also, they were selling a cartridge system. So your cost per unit was going to be like $20, half of which was going to be the cartridge cost, and the other half was going to be the license. And then you're going to need to pay for all of this up front, hundreds of thousands of units, and it's going to cost a ton of money, which, historically, media, it doesn't cost anything. The cost of a paperback book, it's pennies. Cost of a DVD, pennies. Same thing with CD media, same thing. Pretty much radio waves over the air, pretty cheap. And this is really important to the public because if a medium is going to be successful, you don't want there to be a lot of costs associated with it that make it impossible for creative people to bring something to market. So anyway, I can see Nintendo has a big, big problem, and I couldn't really specifically solve it with Nintendo, but I also was already then preoccupied with the transition from 8-bit to 16-bit computing. And I'd worked on this at Apple. I had been one of the leaders involved in the development of the next generation systems, the Lisa and the Mac. And that whole product line was built on the Motorola MC68000 processor. In fact, I was working with Steve Jobs. He and I collectively decided that that would be the processor that we would base our next generation on, and then did a lot of the work to make all that happen. And so by the time I'm at EA, I'm really looking forward to what we can do when we have 16-bit machines at home, but they're still too expensive. And then the Commodore Amiga came along in the mid-80s. I thought, wow, this is an incredible product. But Commodore really didn't know what they were doing. So we made a lot of great games for it, but it was a small market. And then Sega announces, and this is a time where we've had 8-bit consoles like the Nintendo NES. And they cost around $100. They have very little memory in them. Even the cartridges may only have like 8 kilobytes of RAM or 16 kilobytes. And here's Sega, who in the 8-bit generation had had only 1% market share. So Nintendo had 98% market share. And Sega's saying, hey, we're going to introduce the first 16-bit system. And one of the problems that I was having during the 1980s is that most personal computers did not have two joystick ports. They did not have sound chips. They did not have graphics processors. So, it was pretty lousy. I mean, it was hard to play with a friend. The graphics were really slow and clunky. The sound was terrible. That's pretty bad. And here's Sega, and they're going, okay, we got a console. We're going to introduce it at a price of $189. It's got a Motorola 16-bit processor in it. It's got a sound chip. It's got a graphics chip. It's got two joystick ports. And I think, wow, we've got all this Commodore Amiga software. Like we had done an almost perfect port of Marble Madness that had come over from an Atari $10,000 cabinet arcade machine, also based on the Motorola MC68000. And we thought, well, shoot, we can port that to the Amiga. Well, we ported it from the Amiga to the Sega Genesis. And it's a darn good looking Genesis product. So I looked at that and I thought, these guys don't have a lockout chip that's patented like Nintendo has, which make it really hard to reverse engineer it, but we tried. But with the Sega, I thought, I think we got a clean shot here to reverse engineer it and just be able to publish our own games independently. That really was financially the turning point for the company. And I drove that agenda. And, the first decade of the company, I had a strong grip on it. And generally, people did what I wanted with the strategy of the company. This was one where it was obviously a big risk. A lot could go wrong. You have to do reverse engineering correctly. You're going to end up with a legal battle. They might change their product later to try to mess with what you've learned from the one that you figured out. It's a very tedious, complicated product, and you have to get developers to agree to go into the clean room and take on this incredibly difficult problem of figuring out how something works, knowing that they'll never be able to make games for it. And that's because they will have to violate copyright law to display. If you have a symbolic debugger and you're trying to figure out, okay, here's a game and here's the game code in the machine, and now when I want to look at the game code, well, you've just made on the screen an illegal copy of somebody's game code. But that's allowed as a fair use under copyright law, as long as you don't personally profit from publishing any
Got it.
content on that machine. So you're asking, these are like for me, the biggest heroes that I ever work with. Guys like Jim Nichols and Steve Hayes and David Maynard and other guys that all right, we'll go do it. These are guys that had created games. They were some of our highest level technical directors. So they were the right heroes to send on this dangerous mission. And it took several months. You go through months and months where you have no idea what's going on, you can't figure things out, and you're waiting for some big breakthroughs. And it was Jim Nichols after almost a year, that made the biggest breakthroughs. They released the Sega Genesis in 1988. So, we go to Japan, we buy a bunch of them, and we start back in California. And it took us more or less until the fall of the next year, which was the same time they were, gearing up to launch the product in the United States for its first Christmas. And so we didn't have products ready by then, but by the time that Christmas rolled around, we had a bunch of developers starting projects using all the information that we'd gleaned and the tools that we'd created to help them do it. And then as we got closer to the launch, which was in June of 1990, I thought, it's actually still possible to be partners with Sega as long as they're reasonable. And I think it might be just courteous to let them know what we're doing so they're not taken by surprise and too pissed off about it at this summer CES show in Chicago. And so about 2 months before CES, I called up the chairman of the board of Sega and told him what we were doing. And of course, he just started yelling and screaming at me. He says, Trip, you're jeopardizing your company. This is an irresponsible thing to do. You're a CEO of a public company. This is going to result in a huge lawsuit that you're going to lose. And furthermore, when we ship the product in America, we're going to change it so your games won't work anymore. Just blah, 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 blah. And I'm thinking, yeah, he's not really going to change my mind. Anyway, so we agreed, okay, well, let's have a meeting and talk about it. So we got together, a bunch of us got together a few weeks later at Sega's offices, and they got clear on the idea that, yeah, Tripp's pretty sure he's going to win the lawsuit. He may be right, he may be wrong, but that's what he thinks. And so they began to realize that, okay, we're going to need to, find a way to do something. And I didn't know it at the time. The way I looked at it was they can't stop me from being independent. We've really carefully followed the rules of, successful reverse engineering. And I was comfortable with the idea that, okay, if there's going to be a lawsuit, I've taken the company public and raised enough cash that I know we have the ability to defend ourselves and fight it out to win a lawsuit. But it would make even more sense for us to be partners. And I'd said this when I first called him up. I said, why don't we just go hand in hand into the marketplace and beat Nintendo, work together to beat Nintendo. And, again, they're still trying to figure out how they can hang on to some of the kind of controls they wanted to have that were based on them kind of copying Nintendo's license agreement. And of course, I wasn't going to agree to that kind of stuff. But we ended up pretty quickly getting it down to, okay, I'll give you guys $2 million and we'll have a license agreement and we're going to get to do anything we want, anywhere we want to do it. And we'll give you $2 per unit that we manufacture until we reach 1 million units. And that means we will have paid you a total of $2 million and we're not going to pay any more. So they were saying, no, there can't be a cap like that. There was a meeting with my executive staff about 10 days before the CES show where we're going to debut publicly. And we're in these conversations with Sega, but they're not finished. We haven't drafted an agreement yet. And there's kind of a sticking point about this ceiling, that's, at the $2 million level, at 1 million units at $2 a piece. And of course, that $2 is hardly anything. I mean, if we'd signed a conventional license with them or Nintendo, it would have been more like $12. So a huge difference maker for us. And here I am in my executive staff meeting, and they're all saying, Tripp, you've done a great job. You've gotten fantastic terms. Don't screw this up over the cap at 2 million. It's not going to be a problem for us to just keep paying the $2. And I basically said, they may not agree with us right away. What may be necessary is that they insist on it. I say no. We go to the show, they file the lawsuit. We go through discovery of documents. They can tell that we're seriously going to go the distance on the lawsuit. And then at that point, they'll decide, all right, let's just agree and have that $2 million cap in there. And everybody in the room is just rolling their eyes, thinking, oh my God, why is Tripp doing this? Well, that decision worked out for me. So a week later at CES, we're finalizing the contract and they had folded the tent on that one. EA in the next few years made a shit ton of money, but just holding the fort on that $2 million cap, that added probably around $40 million to the bottom line in the next few years. So that decision was worth a lot of money. And the value of the company went up by 30 times. Obviously there's been a lot of stock splits and stuff like that, but it's as if the stock price went from like $6 to $200. It's that big a difference in about a 2 year period in the early 1990s. And that really made the company and set us up because, of course, we're cranking out like 50 new Sega games a year. And we work with all of our distribution, studio partners. And hey, if you don't want to make Sega games, we'll make them for you. Just give us a license, we just built a massive Sega Genesis product line, and they were in the market before Nintendo and ended up going from 1% market share to more like 50, in that 16-bit generation. And of course, that success, I realized, I'm not going to get away with this again. They're all going to see me coming. So I need to do something different to try to escape this cartridge problem, this toxic license agreement problem. And that's when I realized that the next generation, 32-bit CD media, optical discs, internet network, I realized, okay, all of this stuff is possible, including, much better graphics chips. And none of the hardware companies are really doing any of this stuff. Maybe I need to define the hardware spec and, put together a team to build it out and then license it to everybody else. I'm really alarmed about the Nintendo business model, and I want to take the industry in a different direction. And that's really how 3DO came together. But it was really a bridge too far. It was too much. And Sony considered being involved in 3DO, but they had already started the PlayStation project. It was a couple of years behind 3DO, but close enough for them to say, yeah, we'll just do our own thing. And Sony put, I think, $2 billion into the PlayStation business. 3DO and 3DO's hardware partners never had access to money like that. So it was almost a foregone conclusion. That was definitely a big disappointment. And in hindsight, I realized that it was a bold idea, and a lot of people still feel that way about it. And of course, we sold about 1 million 3DO machines. There's a really interesting fan base today that is still very devoted to the product, and a lot of big time collectors and discussions and forums and so on. But it was an unfortunate experience for me because I got kind of annoyed with EA because of some of their behavior in the 1990s related to 3DO. And so I said, oh, screw it. And I sold all my EA stock. Then I pretty much put most of the money back into 3DO. And this is where I got schooled on the fact that, as an entrepreneur, you should not be the bank that's funding your business. You really need an independent banker that's not emotionally involved.
Sorry.
And of course, 3DO didn't make it, so that was a massive, financial failure for me.
So post three, I guess first I want to say, it's very clear that throughout your career, when you see something, you are very willing to take a big swing and go for a home run. So that's very commendable. But after 3DO, you started another company called Digital Chocolate. I think it's another one that a lot of folks know. Why did you start Digital Chocolate? And you were very early to sort of like mobile gaming. This is just like another thing that you saw, I think, earlier than a lot of other folks. So yeah, I'd love to hear the story. Why did you think social gaming, as it was called, was like the next big thing? And yeah, we'll go from there.
The phrase social gaming didn't really appear until maybe 2005, 2006. Facebook came out in 2005, and that's when people began to realize, oh, this is a social platform. So I had recognized that years earlier and had always felt, even as a kid, for me, the most important thing about play and games was to play with people. And half the world's introverts, we don't really always know what to talk about and how to have a conversation. You ask a lot of introverts, they'll tell you, yeah, before I have that conversation, I really planned it out. I figured out the first three, four, five sentences I'm going to say. That's what introverts need to do. So we actually love it when there's a context, like a game that's being played, that's providing the social format, and we get to just do that together and talk about it. It makes social life go much more smoothly. So I'd always known that. We had done really early experiments like Mule, one of the first EA games. We designed that for the four joystick ports of the Atari 800, so you could have four people off the same screen. And of course, we're really into having the sports games be head-to-head two-player games. And then you might recall that when the 3DO version of FIFA came out, which was within a year or two of the birth of FIFA as a brand for EA. But you can play with six players with the 3DO version because we daisy chained the joysticks. And in theory, somebody could have designed a game that had, I think, 16 joysticks all talking to the same 3DO and the same screen. So, we'd also done Modem Wars with Danny Button. And anyway, so always interested in using networking and having social gaming be a thing. And I began to notice with feature phones around 25 years ago, I noticed, okay, this is a new medium. It's going to go beyond it just being a voice device. I can see people starting to do texting and, all the social behavior around that, around the same time that instant messaging was coming out on PCs. So, I'm just paying attention and noticing all this stuff and realizing that games are going to be a great content category or are going to ultimately be in a social driven format. Back in 2003, when I started Digital Chocolate, I was calling the mobile phone the social computer. And the media loved that. They thought, oh, wow, that's really clever. That's really interesting. Tell me more about that. So they wrote a lot about that. And then, of course, Facebook came along, and then the word social showed up a whole lot more often. But digital chocolate, it started out with the feature phones, which were pretty limited, and we still were able to make some pretty great games like Tower Blocks. And then there started to be all these changes in the industry, going through, well, what do you want to do about the Facebook API? And they lured a lot of companies to their death with what they did there. We were one of them. And then, of course, the app stores come out, and we're back to the Nintendo style business model. And Apple at that time, they were really annoying to deal with because I had these really fascinating, innovative ideas, like having a digital item. Today we have this stuff called Web3, and I'm involved in it. I basically had some good Web3 ideas way before Web3. And one of them was, yeah, this is going to be a digital collectible. And the reason that it's going to have more value is that you're going to be able to play with it and develop it and improve it. In the same way that, yeah, you're playing Warcraft, you want to get your avatar to level 60. This is an item that could get to its own version of level 60. And furthermore, you can use it in a game like Warcraft, but then you could also use it in a basketball game, and you could also use it in a chess game, and you could. And no matter where it goes, it's going to basically earn experience points and level up. And you're going to have a relationship with it. And it's going to become your favorite thing, kind of like Pikachu for, fans of Pokemon. I had a patent on that idea. I tried to commercialize it a couple of times, but Apple wouldn't even let me do it on the iPhone. Oh, the Apple said, oh, that's not a terminal good. And I go, what does that even mean? And nobody at Apple could explain to me. What they really meant was, no. Basically, there's a thing, and then somebody can choose to buy it or not, and then that's the end of it. And it really does one, it functionally does one thing. People pay for it, and that's that. Apple was so screwed up in those days, they banned virtual currency. It took them 3 years from the time that I started complaining about it. They, finally go, oh, yeah, you can do that. And there were a lot of people doing it without Apple's permission. And I kept saying to Apple, how come you're telling me I can't do it? And then you're letting these other companies do it and say, well, that's none of your business. It, basically, they didn't have the resources and time to police all the little guys, but they had a direct managed relationship with a big one like us. And we had six games that ranked number one in downloads. We had hundreds of millions of downloads, but there were so many things broken about the business models in that time period. And you're trying to pivot and figure out how to adjust to this rapid period of change, and digital chocolate just didn't make it through.
Digital chocolate obviously was quite successful, but do you think in a way it was even ahead of its time? Again, it ties into like you just being like a visionary and willing to like really go after these trends. But it was like years before the iPhone,
Well,
many, many
yeah,
years before Candy Crush.
here's my favorite example is that we created a dating game where you create avatars and then you give them fashion, you give them personality attributes. And then you send them on dates with other avatars that you don't control. And you get the avatars start having a relationship. Of course, there are human beings behind the avatar. It's almost like the humans are putting on a puppet show, right? But it was very intentional that, yeah, this is going to be a way to, actually meet a real person. And I had seen this way back in 1996. 3DO launched the first MMO, Meridian 59. It's a super hardcore game, dog eat dog. Players were killing other players. That was a really big controversial thing. And next thing we knew, the avatars were arranging to get married to each other in the game. And then after a while, some of the avatars got married in real life and made babies. And I'm thinking, wow, this social value of gaming, I did not expect this. I didn't think that people would get married and have children after playing a hardcore, ambitious, game. Wow.
I mean, today people are meeting their spouses in games and having families from games and all that stuff.
Again, it's maybe not everybody's cup of tea, but out of the global population, there's at least 4 billion introverts, and we need this kind of social facilitation. And there's plenty of extroverts that have fun with it as well. So that's why, the world now has over 10 billion smart devices. We've got over 5 billion smartphones. We've got over 2 billion smart TVs. We've got billions of PCs. It all makes the console install base look tiny. And again, it just shows you that as it goes mainstream, it's not about hardcore games and hardcore gamers playing on specialized hardware.
So, Trip, obviously having been in the gaming industry for so long, I'm curious today, what are some of the games that you play if you are a gamer today? And what are some of the games that really influenced you throughout your career?
Today, what has always been and remains the most precious thing to me is sitting down with family members around a table and playing any kind of game that you can play around a table. And of course, we'll do that with some of the online games like Psych and Among Us. Generally, when there's family around, we're getting out devices and playing whatever the latest kooky fun party type game is. And I do some hardcore sports stuff that is kind of a derivative of fantasy sports. It's genuinely my hobby. It's designed around baseball. And I'm often sitting next to one of my kids while they're playing. My youngest child is still a teenager, and I've always been a natural researcher. I love studying what customers are doing. Generally, like I can find out about a video game, and I don't really feel like I need to play it to understand it. All I have to do is go watch some YouTube videos and listen to somebody talk about it. And I'm always interested in what other designers are doing. So I'm always fascinated by any breakthrough success. Like when Fortnite came out, I really went to school on Fortnite, and my son got heavily into playing it. So I just spent a lot of time having him be my research subject. And Fortnite, it's a parody of a shooter. So at first when everybody's playing it, they're all preoccupied with, oh, I got killed again. I keep getting killed. I've never won yet. Well, of course you haven't won. There's 64 people on the battle bus, and there's only going to be one winner. So you're going to have to play a whole lot. My son was very depressed about dying all the time. But as soon as he and some friends got together to play it, they would form a squad, and then they would have each other's backs. And what's interesting, when they would go out and compete against others, if one of them died, the others would just kill themselves so they could all start over together. Isn't that charming? So, it's just really an indication that Fortnite, it's not trying to take itself too seriously. It's not trying to be PUBG or Call of Duty. And it's basically saying, yeah, hey, you're all welcome here. It was one of the first games to have real, genuine crossplay. I was talking about crossplay 15 years ago and saw tremendous merit. And of course, we're not that far removed from that Blizzard conference at some gaming convention. And I think this was about 5 years ago, where they announced they were going to do a mobile version of Diablo. And the crowd is a PC crowd. Fortnite really started to normalize crossplay, and it's a virtuous cycle because, okay, I discovered this game, I'm playing on my PC, I tell you about it, and you can play on your Xbox. And there's another friend, well, they play it on their iPhone. Of course, they get their ass kicked. And next thing you know, they're going to buy an Xbox because that's what you're using to win, And it used to be these platforms all competed against each other, but because of the social value, the fact that everything's free to play, yeah, you can go invite people and say, hey, let's do this together. That's why, when family comes over, yeah, that's what we do. And everybody can use, their own personal device and platform, and it's pretty awesome. It's very inclusive, and then because it's free, there's no social risk. It's like if I went to you and said, hey, I just bought this $70 game and you got to play this with me. You're thinking, well, do I want to spend the 70 bucks or not? And of course, if you spend the 70 bucks and then you hate the game, it's going to have an impact on our friendship, So yeah, this is a very different social scheme. And I would argue that the second most important thing now is convenience factor. So mobile is very convenient. You've always got it with you, no matter where you are. And then the cloud is also really convenient. So I'm a very cloud-based user. I actually spend, when I'm on my phone, using apps on my phone, I'm actually more in the browser than I am in apps. And again, it has to do with my baseball hobby, true confession. Plus I'm, looking at industry news and other stuff. Besides that aspect of convenience, it's like no matter where I go, Google's got all my stuff in the cloud. I can get to my Gmail on the hotel computer or at a library, or on somebody else's phone if I don't have one. And I just kind of feel like the cloud is everything.
So, you're very well known within the gaming industry. And as a result, you've done a lot of investing and advising, and I'm sure you get asked all the time. I can't tell you how many pitch decks I've seen Trip Hawkins is an advisor at Trip Hawkins, did XYZ for this company. So how do you actually decide which companies or founders you want to spend your time on? And then how do you balance being involved with, multiple different companies and all the other things that you're doing while still making sure that you're actually adding value?
Yeah, so of course, throughout my career, there have always been people pretending to be me or putting words in my mouth. So you should double check it if somebody says that
Sure.
I'm helping them or whatever. But occasionally, if somebody reaches out to me, they might do that through my social media or they might have obtained my email. And I'm a pretty good-natured person. When a nice person wants some help, I like helping people. I mean, I have found it's one of the most important purposes of my entire life. I mean, ever since I was a kid, I was a playground leader, classroom leader. People rallied around me because I would help them. And that goes on to becoming a good boss and knowing how to take care of people and develop them and help them have a great career. I particularly enjoy helping people from underserved communities. So I'm way more interested in that just because I've obviously had enough time to figure out that, I benefited from white privilege and there's all these other people that have had the deck has been stacked against them. And that's really nasty and unfair, and unfairness really bothers me. I do a certain amount of stuff just for free, just to help people. And then I do some of this as work, but the kind of way I organize it as work is more like an investor. But I think more like a founder. Founders have common stock, and then venture firms get capital from limited partners, and their limited partners are, big badass, institutions, and they want to be protected by the preferences. And I don't know. I like being aligned with the founders. It's not really like it's a job. I'm not an employee. It's in my interest to be like a venture capitalist. If I put some money into an early stage company, I want to try to figure out how to grow the value of my equity interest. Of course, that means you have to grow it enough that common has value. That's a challenging thing. So I only work with people that are fun. I only work with people that are willing to go on a journey to really get to know themselves better, which means they've got to be not kind of stuck on a certain perception about themselves that's getting in their own way. That's a surprising problem. And the reason this matters to me is that, for me, it's more about helping the people than it is about helping the companies. And to help the people, you've got to help them figure out who they are. And this was a long, slow, painful journey for me personally. And about 30 years ago, I realized I needed to do a lot of work on myself. But it just sort of unfolded over the last 30 years, learning new things that I hadn't really previously understood about myself, and that's still going on. And then looking at all of the wisdom that's available that you can learn about, and then all of the practices that you can start to engage in order to be a healthier, happier person. And I'm talking about things like meditation, positive thinking, growth mindset. I've kind of become an expert at this stuff, using myself as a guinea pig and operating myself like a scientist. And I've read literally thousands of books having to do with wellness and relationships and personality and other related topics. I have tried everything myself, and I kind of know which books are worth reading and which videos are worth watching and which practices actually work. And so I drag all my clients kicking and screaming into doing these kinds of things, as well as kind of helping them get to a deeper, more vulnerable understanding of, what happened in their childhood that they don't really understand? Why do they behave this way? Everybody's got certain things that trigger them. But by the time they're triggered and they're acting out emotionally like a 3-year-old, by the time that happens, they have not been consciously aware that they have that emotional sensitivity. So it's just one of those things where, I had a real serious anger management issue when I was younger that I eventually figured out that in the childhood scheme that I was in from the very beginning, I didn't feel safe. It was very much a performance-based system. There wasn't a lot of affection and positive feedback unless you were performing at boot camp. And then there's also a threat of punishment that was just ever present. And the children were encouraged to compete with each other. So it was dog eat dog. And, you know, I just carried that into adult life where my anxiety flares up if I feel like I'm losing an argument. You know, it's like the craziest things happen in business meetings. And what a lot of people don't realize is that they're dealing with really old parts of their psyche and even old human instincts. And all kinds of bad human behavior shows up in business meetings. And it's mainly just because we're so terrified and we're lacking awareness and don't really know how to behave any better. It's like Brené Brown, who's fabulous. Her work is absolutely awesome. One of her pet phrases is, "We're all doing the best we can with the tools we have." You know, and that's what I've tried for the last 3 years is figure out, okay, how do I get a better set of tools and increase my awareness of who I am and what my weaknesses are? And here's one of the ironies is that your biggest strength is your biggest weakness. And it took me a long time to figure that out. You know, when I made my biggest mistakes, I was on a 20-year winning streak. You know, you get to a point where you feel like you've really got it. And that's where you go over the edge.
I think this is great. These candid discussions, I think, just have so much value. What are you most proud of throughout your career?
I think of Electronic Arts as my first child. And I kind of ran the company until it was a teenager, literally. And at that point, I realized, wow, you know, this is a big, strong, capable teenager that they're going to make it into adulthood. And that's when creatively I began to ideate and wander off into domains that were arguably outside the corporate formula that EA wanted to remain in. And that's how I got separated from the company. And, you know, that's my biggest regret is I had never really been a terribly politically shrewd operator. I can notice politics and I can analyze politics, but sometimes I don't see how it's going to affect me, right? I don't see how I get blindsided by sometimes political behavior that I didn't expect. And that had to do with, you know, certain people at EA that were happy to exploit the fact that I was putting a foot over into 3DO and they wanted to help encourage me to move my other foot over there and then slam the door and lock it and never let me back in again. And they achieved that. So it's just been disappointing for me to have been estranged from my first child now for quite a while.
What advice do you have for folks that are just getting started today on their entrepreneurship journeys?
I think one thing is to really know who you are because being an entrepreneur has become fashionable, and that's not the reason to do it. You should not be doing it because you think it's the best way to make money. You know, for me, it's never been about the money. I know money has to be made. You know, if you're going to take money from investors, you're going to have to make money for them, right? If you do that, you're going to make money for yourself, you're going to make money for your employees. But if that's your focus, you know, you probably really ought to just be a banker.
You know, obviously, looking in the rearview mirror, you've accomplished a ton. You know, you've had a career that I think a lot of people would, dream to have accomplished a fraction of what you have. So, obviously, that's incredible. But, like I said, I still see you're very active. You know, you're still involved in many companies. You're still trying to help people out. So what else do you still want to accomplish going forward? It can be either personally or professionally or some combination. But what still drives you today? What all do you still want to accomplish?
Yeah, that's a good question. When I was a CEO, I was late for dinner a lot. You know, I had four kids. In hindsight, didn't feel comfortable, for example, giving myself permission to be a little league coach. I have some regret about that because, you know, the kids are not going to wait. They're not going to stop growing and wait till you show up. You know, I've spent a lot of time with my kids and done a lot of things with them, but more is better, you know, and you know, they're all really fascinating adults now and really fun people to hang out with. And they're all up to really interesting things. And so the more time with them, the better. And of course, I feel like, yeah, you know, they're scattered now. Like I've got a kid in London, one's, you know, spent most of the last 5 years in Brooklyn. Another one is in LA. Another one's down in Irvine. That's the youngest one who just started college. And yeah, I understand that for the rest of my life, I'm going to probably be the one who has to make more effort to get to where they are. I really enjoy getting them together. I got three of them together in Spain last summer, which was cool. And yeah, we have gatherings, you know, here in Santa Barbara kind of on a regular basis. In fact, one of my kids is back in the house for the weekend. Yeah. So, family, it's just one of those things where when you're living the dream, you're really busy and not getting much sleep. And when you look back on it, I think a lot of people realize that it would have been nice if they'd spent more time with their kids. So I think I still have plenty more gas in the tank, and I want to make sure I do that and do anything I can do to help them in their lives. And I'm very happily married, and it took me a really long time to figure out how to do that. And so just quality time with my wife is really awesome. And I'm a big time traveler. I've been to over 80 countries. There's still a lot of places on my bucket list. And things that I'd like to do. And we're empty nesters now for the first time. And so, okay, now our schedules are quite a bit more flexible. So that's kind of cool. But yeah, those are things that just kind of top of mind.
Awesome. Well, Trip, thank you again for being a guest. I think this was a great conversation. And I hope my listeners will be able to learn a lot and be entertained. So thanks for taking the time. Thanks for
My
joining me.
pleasure. Thanks, Chris. Take care.